Once you find your area of interest, like really hammer on it, you know, make it work in whatever class you're in. If you have a paper that you need to do for whatever, like find a way of incorporating your interest into your class somehow.
You're listening to Beyond the Jargon, a conversation with graduate students about their research journeys at the University of Victoria. Welcome to Beyond the Jargon. I'm your host today, Liz MacArthur, and joining me in the studio is Zach Lewis, who is doing a Master's of Sociology.
That's right, yep.
Welcome. Thank you for joining me today.
Yeah, no problem. I'm happy to be here.
I'm interested to know how you got into what you're studying now. As I mentioned before we started, I look people up before we go into the interview, find out a little bit about them. And maybe this has something to do with it or maybe it doesn't. But one thing that I thought was interesting was when I searched your name, something came up about a book that you had read that had influenced your studies.
Oh, yeah. Actually, that's interesting. Huh. I don't know exactly what that reference is because I haven't seen it myself.
Right.
But if I had to guess, that's probably Rebel Cell. It's a sociology or a book by a couple of sociology profs from U of T, I think, or at least they were at the time of when it was published. It's about sort of branding in society and how they change. They hijack sort of trends of rebelliousness and sell it. And so things like how Che Guevara became so popular and how punk rock became this from this fringe thing to this very popular music. It was a really, really interesting read. And it was before I had even considered going to university. But sort of when I came to the point where I was ready to go to school, it was it made me motivated in sociology. It's what brought me to Sociology 100.
Hmm. Why? Just because of the content and the way that people think about these things?
Yeah. So the content of the book was, yeah, basically this, it was talking about social norms sort of before I knew what social norms were, and, you know, all these things that I can sort of point to what the jargon is now. Having reread the book, it's like, it makes a lot more sense to me now. But even then, it really just touched on a lot of things that were really tangible in my life. Just thinking about why I buy things. I think I've always thought sociologically. I just didn't know what the academic frame of reference was. And so I guess this was just one of those moments where it just kind of like that. And reading philosophy like John Ralston Saul took me to philosophy in the same sort of way. So it was just, it was just kind of a natural extension, I guess, of what I was already interested in.
Hmm. What does that mean when you say you think you always thought sociologically?
I'll give you an example. On my way home over reading break a couple weeks ago there, or a week ago maybe because I went the second weekend, but anyway, I stopped in Duncan at this place called The Garage. It is an organic food, bookstore, grocery store, kind of everything mixed into one big place. And I had this moment where I was sitting there and I thought to myself, everyone that's in here that buys from this organic store is white. And this is in Duncan, which is, you know, has a massive indigenous community. In fact, you can't own land in Duncan. It's all owned by the indigenous communities of the area. And they sort of lease it to people, basically, is what effectively happens. You can't actually own. And so anyway, just sort of in the dynamic of this is such a largely indigenously populated area. And within this area, there's this place that promotes health and well-being, and yet it is populated only by white people. And so I like to refer to these kinds of things now as like sociological moments. But I think before I ever entered into sociology, I was always really interested in kind of thought of why things were out of place like this. I think now I think even more critically in that direction. So
let's talk a little bit about what specifically you're doing for your master's now, because I didn't actually talk about that at all.
So for my master's, I am interested in critical discourse analysis. Discourse is basically any combination of language, images. It's the kind of things that make up how we think, how we act in society is manipulated by what we see, what we hear, conversations that we have, dialogues that we see on computer screens. I'm specifically looking at websites of Enbridge Northern Gateway Pipeline websites and looking at how their discourse relates to their relationships with Indigenous communities. And specifically with reference to Indigenous communities, to a large extent, are in resistance to pipelines such as this, or to this pipeline in particular, you know, especially, and they portray an image of partnership and consent and those kinds of things. Like they're appreciating the duty to consult that they have, and this discourse is connected to sort of a larger network of discourse centered from sort of a national level, where people like Harper are saying, you know, assuming that we have Indigenous and communities on board, we're going to move ahead with these pipelines. They've been approved by our environmental assessment board and things like that. And so all these discourses sort of shape how people view these pipeline projects to be, and how they view Indigenous people's part in them, and kind of takes away from their position of resistance because how they're portrayed in sort of media and online.
Yeah, I think that is something that probably a lot of people, you know, are in some level are aware of, you know, that the what's portrayed, online in the media is not necessarily the reality on the ground. I think an example might be, you know, those islands that were erased in there. I think it was Enbridge's video when they were showing, like, the tankers will just come right in and there's no islands. It's fine.
Well, that's not, like, specifically something that I'm that is an interesting point, though, that maybe I guess I could include. I'm more looking at specifics of the image. So, for example, on their website, they have these really beautiful images of coastline and you know, pristine sort of snapshots of panoramic views of mountains and of the ocean. And it really, the color and the ambience of the website overall kind of gives you this feeling of, like, appreciation of the beauty of nature, which is sort of, I mean, the opposite of what you would expect when you're looking up a pipeline, I guess. And so I guess I'm trying to tease out sort of how they're co-opting these kinds of, because a lot of what critical discourse analysis wants to say is that it's manipulating the way we're thinking about these subjects without us being particularly conscious of them. So when we see these beautiful skylines and ocean shots and mountains, it doesn't have a direct effect in the sense that you see it and you have, like, I love mountains or something like that. It's more subtle and it's more operates on a little bit more of a subconscious level, where it's maybe you're looking up these websites because you're concerned about pipelines. Like, that's what a lot of people are looking into these websites for, right? It's because they have obvious concerns and maybe ought to have concerns about environmental impacts or potential environmental impacts of the pipelines, you know? And so when they're welcomed with that image, it's, I think it has, like, a calming effect or, like, and so that's the kind of thing that I want to tease out of these websites by sort of capturing them with screenshots and applying sort of a critical lens to them.
So when you're doing your research, you mentioned screenshots. Are you actually talking to the people that set these up, talking to maybe marketing people who actually... you know, they want to have an image that would be calming for someone? Are you also talking at all to any Indigenous groups about their perception or people's perception as either resistors or people who are on board with the pipelines?
Ultimately, that's what I wanted to do for my thesis. And I'm not sure if I should just say explicitly that, but that's not what I'm doing for my thesis anymore. It was maybe too rigorous of a thing for a master's thesis, maybe. I'm gonna leave it at that to not throw any of my not make any bad political moves on my part with regards to my professors in the sociology department. But I would love and will love to have any involvement with Indigenous communities in particular, with how, because a lot of being critical of what they're putting is subverting meaning. So a lot of the language that they use on these websites is Indigenous ways of knowing, which is sort of a co-opted term. And in order for me to derive what they're trying to do with the meaning, it's important for me to try and understand what it means to Indigenous people. And of course, there's no homogenous Indigenous way of knowing, right? Of course, but you know, it would be really helpful to know from the people that are directly affected. But yeah, it's arduous, I guess, to go out to First Nations communities in the north and interview them, and gaining access to those communities. As myself, I'm a white person, it's much more difficult, I guess, and perhaps they have a right to be jaded towards academia. I'm actually not, I actually don't know. And mm-hmm. It's not really my place to put judgment on any of those types of things. My experience with communicating with Indigenous people has been nothing but them being extremely receptive and interested and open and all of the things that, you know, as a researcher, you would hope that somebody would be, you know.
What initially got you interested in this topic?
Yeah, it's a good question. As much as it's funny, I think maybe one of the things that drew me away from philosophy is that I have a really strong belief in intuition. And any person that takes a lot of philosophy will tell you that intuition is not something that they hold very near and dear to any epistemic view, really, frankly. That's Western philosophy that I can speak to anyway. So yeah, a lot of it was intuitive. I mean, for me, maybe it's kind of ironic that I've come to this place. My grandfather was basically a lumberjack, you know, for lack of a better word, but he owned logging companies and worked with Macmillan Blodell and worked with Wellwood on the island and mm-hmm. was on the other side of the fence on a lot of these things. Not ones that are sort of present to mind. He's 93 in a couple of days here, so there's no way that he will ever hear this radio interview, but nevertheless, he's a pretty awesome person. But he's also very different in terms of his background, his opinion of life and society than I am, to say the least, as I'm sure a lot of people have similar conflicts with their grandparents. But I'm not really sure. Maybe it's a... I'm not sure. It's an interesting question how I came to it, really. I think about that, and I don't really have a concrete answer. It makes me come back. I'm sure that there's lots of reasons. I think that that's probably the best answer I can give.
Your grandfather's influence?
Well, I just mean that he had sort of a negative relationship with First Nations people on the island as a lumberjack. You know, mm-hmm. I don't know I don't think you can be an owner of an extractive company on Vancouver Island and not come into conflict with First Nations communities. I don't know if those two things can actually be separated. I think anytime you're cutting down the forest or mining or even setting up a hydro dam, First Nation communities are going to be they're going to be interested and they're going to be motivated to have a conversation and a dialogue about it. I think that's just a part of our history. Whether or not those dialogues have gone well is also a part of our history too. And I think, you know, as I alluded to, I've had a lot of contact with First Nations people in this community. And definitely one thing that I've learned is that, you know, the present of how people treat First Nations people, and I can speak to myself in this regard because I was really sort of misguided, is to treat them, I'm going to say them, kind of, use my white privilege here and say them, and to treat them as like damaged or broken people, you know, and it's a shame to do that, I think, because there's a lot of very interesting and powerful things that come from, you know, they're not damaged and broken. It's just, it's a reality, and it's a reality that's, you know, obviously we had a significant hand in really, it's not in the past. We had a significant hand in creating. And so, I don't know, I guess the more that I found out about it, the more I was fascinated, because I had such a fixed or different idea of how First Nations communities and Indigenous communities worked, I guess. Yeah, I don't know. It's a good question, though.
So it's sort of, yeah, that extraction, resource extraction company relationship with First Nations. And it seems like it's related to your own personal understanding of how that relationship is shaped and operates.
Yeah, well, but my honors thesis was on Goldcorp, and it's a mining company, which is an extractive company, obviously, as well. Somewhat like Enbridge. It is based out of Vancouver. And a lot of their interactions have been with Indigenous people in Central America. So, and it was really negative. They had some human rights violations filed in, not here, because you can't file them here, or rather Guatemalan people can't file them here. They can only file them in places like the US or in Guatemala, in which case they don't usually go over very well, unfortunately. And so that's a whole nother sort of can of worms. But anyway, it was really interesting to see how, you know, those in their relationship with those Indigenous people, and how they framed their relationship with, they have a mine in Quebec, and it's on Cree land, and they've sort of framed this relationship with this Cree group, Cree community, rather, that's very positive and very much one of like mutual trust and partnership and all of these sort of very positive things. But it's on the same, it's in the same place on their website. It's in the same area of their website as, you know, information about their dealings with Indigenous people around the Marlin mine, which is quite famous for them contaminating their water and giving people basically poisoning people that live there through their water and through their soil and things like that. So yeah, it was a really interesting study for me, because I was trying to tease out this similarities between their dealings with these two Indigenous groups. And in that particular instance, it seemed like their dealings with Indigenous people here were very positive. Of course, that's what you find on their website. What else would you find but positive stories? But anyway, I've never heard anything negative about their relationship with that particular group. So perhaps that's something that they have succeeded at and are doing very well. But yeah, their history in Guatemala is definitely very murky.
Mm-hmm. I think this is something that Canadians in general are not as aware of. The way that Canadian mining companies work in places like Latin America and Africa in some cases. And there are direct comparisons that can be drawn to treatment of Indigenous people in other countries and First Nations here. But I know that there is a lawsuit currently going through the Supreme Court of Canada in Toronto for a group of people from Guatemala.
Okay.
And they've successfully brought their case to the Supreme Court of Canada, yeah, which is interesting to see, like, development on that front. Mm-hmm.
There has been several courts that have heard cases.
Yeah.
It's just there's no bill in place. There's no statute in place to say that these things are illegal. There's no precedent set that a judge has made that allows for them to pass judgment on these cases, because there's no law saying people from another country can bring their human rights complaints. If the company is based, you know, in Canada and they have a complaint against them, they have to legally, according to Canadian law, file in their own country, basically, is essentially how the law works here right now. But yeah, they are hearing the cases. There's just no, from my understanding, there's no statute in place for them to actually, you know, the judges are just handcuffed. So I'm guessing they keep throwing these cases at them in the hopes that they'll
there'll be precedent set.
They'll be a precedent set. Yeah.
Yeah. How did you come to that initially? That topic of like Canadian mining operations and.
Oh, that's another good question. I spent a lot of time in southern Mexico in a community called, the state of Chiapas. Mm-hmm. But there's a town called San Cristobal de Casas that's right near Tuxtla, which is the capital. And it's predominantly Mayan people that live in this town. It's an amazing, amazing little area of several indigenous communities. I think we kind of use the word Mayan like we use the word First Nations, which is that there's many communities that fall under the umbrella of both. And so it's a bit of a misnomer there. But anyway, nevertheless, I spent a lot of time down there. My mom lived down there for 7 years. Mm. And I went down there a few times. And Guatemala is very close to there. It's a lot of the same sort of community, and I actually just heard about this mine firsthand and was keenly aware of Zapatista movement because I had seen some of the their acts of civil disobedience throughout my time spent down there since I guess 2006 or 7. And so yeah, I guess I just again kind of came about it from a place of experience and sort of intuition. It just kind of was something that I was already interested in. And then, I don't know, I was doing some kind of social movements class and I was like, oh, I'll do something. Oh, there is one thing that I should say. Imperial Oil Incorporated, Alain Deneau, he's from Quebec. He's a scholar and he came to UVic and he had a talk about the extractive industry in general in Canada, and it was very much to do with this subject, and it very much like fueled a bit of a fire under me, and I should fully give him credit as well as JP Sapinski for putting on that class. It was like corporations in a globalizing world or something like that, sociology 355 two or three years ago. I'm like dating my university life, but anyway. So yeah, that's sort of, I mean, I guess that's kind of how university life works. If you know, you find those things that you're interested in and you cling to them, because when you're, you know, neck deep in a paper that's taken you 4 months to do and you're at page number 30 and you're tearing your hair out and you're like living and breathing this thing, you better be really kind of passionate and interested in it, because otherwise I can't imagine what it would be like. Probably a lot less fulfilling, or I don't know, because it's already, you know, it already is taxing for me as somebody who is passionate about it. So I can only imagine if I wasn't.
So when did you start your master's?
In September of 2015.
Okay, so how much more time are you spending on it? Are you researching right now? And when do you move into writing? How's that going to work for you?
I am doing courses for the first, you do courses for the first year in sociology. Master's is a 2-year program. So the first year I'll be doing courses. So last year I was doing coursework. This year I'll be doing coursework. I usually direct most of my theory towards my sort of topic of interest. That's just something somewhat of a, I guess, a tip if an undergraduate listens to something like this would be, once you find your area of interest, like really hammer on it, you know, make it work in whatever class you're in. Make it, if you have a paper that you need to do for whatever, like find a way of incorporating your interest into your class somehow. That's how you get to have a really developed and nuanced and well-rounded sort of idea of your subject matter, of the theories that sort of apply to what you want to do, is by doing these kinds of papers and projects and assignments again and again and again in the same pod. As much as that might seem really boring to do the same thing over and over again, that's how you build, I think, and have real understanding, genuine understanding. But at the end of this year, I'm going to take at least a month off. I went straight into my master's from my undergraduate. I don't suggest doing this, particularly if you have the opportunity in August to start in September and you weren't planning on going to grad school. Don't rush into it. It's a lot of hard work. It's totally worth it, but it's a lot of hard work. And I'm not trying to scare anyone away, but just take your break. If you need your break, take your break.
Think before you act. Don't be in
a
rush.
Think before. Yeah, it's not something to be taken lightly. It's a lot of work, and it's you know, it's very much a full time job at this point for me. I'm busy most every day. I don't think I took it that way in my first semester, and I suffered for it greatly. And this semester, it's very much a full-time job. And I love it, but it's you gotta realize your limitations and where you're at sort of with your body and mind too, you know, like you come first, even if you love what you're doing.
Then after this, you've got another year. You're gonna be writing, researching. How does that work?
So my advisor is Bill Carroll. He's doing a 6-year research project on the extractive industry. Surprise, surprise. It's basically about Canadian extractive industry wholesale. So it's like a massive project. It's the largest social sciences grant in Canadian history, I'm pretty sure.
Wow.
It's a huge grant. And my motivation for going to grad school was to sort of be a part of this project in some way, shape, or form. So that hasn't happened yet, but you know, I'm sort of fingers crossed, and we've had a lot of discussions about how I'm going to apply. It's a huge. It's multi universities. It's a massive project. And I shouldn't actually speak to what it is in particular, because in all honesty, it's broader and more thorough than I actually understand at this point, being sort of just being introduced to it as I am. But my research is going to be, as I was mentioning before, a critical discourse analysis on Ambridge's website. What I want to do is sort of just look at how, again, positions of resistance by Indigenous communities are kind of uprooted by discourse. There's actually a study that was just published recently. I don't have the author's name off the top of my head because it literally just dropped on my desk this morning. That was about how media discourse, excuse me, upsets these positions of authority and upsets social movements against pipeline movements. So I'm going to have to definitely dive into that when I get back to my desk, so to speak. But anyway, that's sort of the direction that I'm going. Like, how does their own discourse that they create on their websites, because there's more than one, there's one that's called gatewayfacts.ca or something like that. And it's really interesting because doesn't actually appear to be Goldcorp, Enbridge rather. Mm-hmm. I'm getting my two studies mixed up. it doesn't actually appear to be Enbridge, kind of. Mm-hmm. And so, which is interesting. They're kind of completely removing the image of an oil and gas company altogether in order to, I don't know, promote a more positive image, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
One of pristine natural beauty.
We're pretty much out of time. I want to wish you luck with your studies, and thank you for coming on the show today.
Thanks. It was my pleasure.
Thanks for listening to Beyond the Jargon. If you're interested in being interviewed, please email cfuvcad@uvic.ca. To listen again, you can find a link to the podcast at cfuv.ca.